Right, good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon session. We're into the last stretch of Tech Ed, isn't it a shame? I presume you're all staying for the party tonight? That's why you're here, really, isn't it? My name's Paul Romney. I work for Microsoft Consulting in the UK. And I'm going to talk about availability, resiliency, and recovery. If that's not what you've come for, now's the time to leave. I've worked in IT for more years than I care to remember, about 30 years. Yes, I am that old. And I've seen a lot of disasters in my time. I've caused disasters in my time. I've been there, I've felt the pain, and some of what I'm going to talk about is that sort of experience, because those rules apply to Link as well as everything else. And I'm going to talk about some of the specific things in Link. I'm going to talk about some terminology, first of all, because I spend a lot of time talking to customers, and they'll talk about disaster recovery and when what they actually mean is a DR site, which is not the same thing. Okay? So I'm going to define some terms before we start. I'm going to look at how we determine requirements for availability, resiliency, and recovery. I'm going to talk about some of the effects on Link and how you need to understand those and think about those when you come up with your plan. I'm going to talk about developing a plan, what you need to do. No, you can't take everything I said and do it, but it will set the scene for the sorts of things you need to do. I haven't got time to develop a backup plan with you. It takes time. And I'll look at how to recover Link, the sorts of things you can do. So if you look at terminology, well, I did the sensible thing. I went searching on the net. So I looked at things like Wikipedia and Business Directory. And of course, being English, I looked at the important one, which is the Oxford English Dictionary, and none of them really helped. I mean, I found one example of resiliency is the ability of material to absorb energy when it's deformed elastically and release the energy upon unloading. Well, because that really will help you in your IT environment, won't it? I did find a useful one on networks, ability to provide and maintain an acceptable level of service in the face of faults and challenges to normal operations, I thought was good. So let's define some requirements. High availability. What do I mean when I talk about high availability? And I make that distinction. It's how I've defined it. You and your customers may define it differently, and you need to understand the differences and make sure you're all talking on the same page. It's a level of redundancy that you apply to a system for ensuring that you achieve a degree, an acceptable degree of continued operation during planned and unplanned outages. And that's an interesting one. Sometimes people talk about high availability. Do they include planned or don't they include unplanned or not? So being very clear. The focus, though, of high availability is about keeping the service up and running. Yeah? That's what you're trying to do. Keep the service up and running. Resiliency. The ability to provide and maintain acceptable level of service in the face of faults and challenges to normal operation. What its focus really is to keep the essential services up and running. It's say you may have certain outages that actually you allow for and say, I'll have a reduced service. What are the essential components? Because if you think about Link and other technologies, people say, I need it available all the time. And what they mean is they need this little bit available all the time. There are things that they can actually do without or cope without. And you need to understand what those are, and at what point it's okay for that to happen. Disaster recovery is the restoration or continuation of a technological infrastructure critical to the organization after a natural or human-induced disaster. And we'll come on to that in a bit. It's really about recovering a service to a point in time, in a given time period. And we define this generally in what we call RPO and RTO, recovery point objective and recovery time objective. The point being is you are recovering the service. You may have some data loss, and you've got to determine what is acceptable. So when you start determining requirements, how many of your customers say, I need 4 nines availability? What does 4 nines availability mean? Well, that depends whether you're measuring it by the year, the month, the week, the day, all matters. People out 4.9s, well, is it 4.9s measured over, oh, a year? That means I can actually have 52 minutes of downtime. Yeah? Be very clear when you're talking about requirements what people really mean. Generally, most people do measure it over a month, but that's not always the case. Some people measure it in a year or a week. Because often you've got a service level with a service provider, and they're measuring over a bigger period of time because they recognize that things go up and down. They come in waves. You know, you may have one month where you achieve 100% availability, another month where it's a lot less. So what do you measure it over? So beware of the nines. What does it really mean? Is it really matter? What's the difference between 1 minute downtime and 5 minutes downtime over what period? You have to be aware, though, that the higher number of nines you want to go increases costs and complexity. It's exponential. You know, going from 3 nines to 4 nines and from 4 nines to 5 nines, there's quite a considerable increase in cost to provide that. Is it really important? And this is where you come down to the difference between high availability and resiliency. Your high availability is aimed at trying to achieve those nines. Your resiliency says, I accept that I may have circumstances where I lose some service, but there are those essential elements I need to keep running. And you need to decide what is essential. When will resiliency be enough? And it's surprising how often it is enough. So what types of errors? Well, most errors are actually hardware failures, often within the server room, sometimes between server rooms. 32% human errors. You may disagree with my percentages. Search the internet. You'll find similar sorts of figures and similar numbers. The interesting one is 3% are natural disasters. The earthquake, the flood, the major power failure, whatever it happens to be. But that's the one people always think about. I said people talk about disaster recovery. I mean a DR site. And what you're actually covering is about 3% of disasters. So you need to think about what different disasters are. Power failure, network failure, what sort of things might happen there. Software failure, crashes, bugs. Yes, they do exist, unfortunately. Human error. Human error. I'm going to demo human error. We gave you a wonderful tool. And tell me my machine's crashed again. Oh, I love it when this happens. I will talk about my human error while my machine's rebooting. Just rebooting. This one I'll talk about rather than show you. We'll flip back to the slides. Human error, PowerShell. PowerShell is the most wonderful tool we've ever given you. But how often do you use it, and how often do you make a mistake? Well, I did once. I had a customer, and unfortunately, I live in the UK, and there are time zone differences, and my customer had sites in the US, which puts them about 6 hours behind the UK, which means I have to make changes at midnight. How many of you are really awake at midnight? Yeah? Well, that's when errors occur. We had a situation where we'd create a lovely dial plan. They had a wonderful dial plan, far too complex. They had wonderful site code routing, and I'd implemented this, or I thought I had, and they phoned up and said, it's not working. And I very quickly went in and found what I'd done wrong. I'd missed the $1 off the translation pattern. Very easily done, which meant the numbers were translating without putting the extension bit on the end. And I thought I'd be very clever. I quickly wrote some I typed in some PowerShell. I did the sensible thing. I'm a consultant. I did the sensible thing. I did a get first to make sure I was getting just a subset of information. Having done the get, I piped it into a variable. Very good. Very, very easy to do. And then I wrote a for loop. And the for loop went round and change the translation, put $1 on the end. Unfortunately, I made a typo in the command. I'm dyslexic. That's my excuse. And unfortunately, what that meant is it blanked it out. Now, fortunately, being a consultant, I'd also done the other right thing. I backed up the configuration before I started. And I just went and put the configuration back. But it is very, very easy with PowerShell, even when you're trying to do the right thing, to make mass changes that have big impacts. Right? Human error like that is one of the biggest causes of disaster. And having a DR site wouldn't have helped me. Yeah? I needed a backup of some data. Right? So when you start looking at these things, it comes quite important. Let me just start my machines. I know why I cut off, actually. My power supply is not working. My machine went into standby. That's better. I will talk and operate at the same time. So, recovery requirements. You need to think about what your recovery point objective is and what your recovery time objective is. It's very easy to think I need everything immediately, everything up to date. The problem is, the closer you get to seconds, the more expensive it gets. So things like synchronous replication, global clustering, they're expensive solutions. How up to date does your data need to be when you're doing a recovery? And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about disasters that require recovery. And if you think about Link, most of your data, I say most of your data in Link is fairly static. How often do you add a contact to your buddy list? All right, you've got to multiply that by 10,000 users. Well, if I had to restore the system because of a disaster, would it matter that I've missed a buddy and somebody's got to re-add it? How difficult it is to recover that data from somewhere else. If you think about meetings, meeting content, how many of you upload meeting content to a meeting before the meeting? The love. Now, most people don't. I work with organizations that some of them do. I work with local government. Local government loves structured meetings. They love having agendas beforehand. They love having, you know, documents you've got to read beforehand. And they may well load them up to the meeting workspace and onto the meeting beforehand. It's an unusual case. You have to be aware of it. But in most cases, people don't. So if I lost my Link server, what data am I going to lose if I went back 24 hours? Not very much, because all my present data is transient. Most of it, yeah, if I've lost meeting content, I can usually reload it because it's somewhere else. Yeah? So there isn't much. Now, there are exceptions that you need to be aware of, and you may need to consider. So, what would happen if I lost my archive that I need for compliance? Yeah? So there may be bits of data you need to consider about how you provide backup and restore and that sort of thing. Well, most of that's stored in SQL. You can replay the SQL logs, even if you restore to recovery point. But you've got to be aware you need to do that. So you need to think about some of those things. So when we look at the Link components, so there's a lot of bits of Link, and they have different requirements and different needs. You know, within the pool, you've got different components, within the director. I'm going to drill down into each of these. So the enterprise pool is about high availability. That's its objective, right? It has multiple front ends, right? It has a SQL cluster. Anybody here know what SQL cluster failover time is? Anyone have a guess? 2 minutes, yeah. It is about 2 minutes. People forget. So I do my monthly patch on my SQL server, and it takes 2 minutes to fail over. Oh. How long does it take to reboot a SQL server? Not much different. Right? So sometimes you put these things and you think, why am I doing it? There are reasons, said, particularly when you start looking at archiving things. So you need to think about those. You know, having said that, there are things we do about resiliency of SQL. Hardware load balancers. Hardware load balancers is part of your solution. You might say, I'm using DNS load balancing, it doesn't matter. Yes, it does. If you're at my conferencing session this morning, you'll understand that the web element of Link is important to your conferences. It's there for meeting joins. It's there for meeting content. There for group expansion. So it's part of... So how often do you just expect another team to provide your hardware load balancer without any thought about whether it's highly available or not? What are they doing? File shares. There's a file share. Cluster, SAN, DFS, decide how you're going to make it highly available. SQL. If the SQL server goes down, I was going to show it to you, but I can't wait several minutes. That's the sort of thing that happened. The client will carry on. Limited functionality. It goes into a resiliency mode. Right? We've built some capability. Because the front end can't talk to the back end SQL, there are certain things it won't be able to do. But there are certain things it will carry on doing. If you need to make a voice call, you can still make a voice call. When we look at the edge needs a high availability. There's various components. So you need to consider whether you're using DNS load balancing or hardware load balancing. There are pros and cons to that behind outside availability. If you're using hardware load balancing, is that highly available or not? Does it matter? If I've got a reverse proxy, is it a single server or multiple servers? You know, what's the availability within a reverse proxy server? Your firewalls. How many customers have got, you know, highly available firewalls? Quite a lot, but not everybody. And you're dependent on all this to provide your high availability to your service. When we look at voice, voice has a lot more components. Exchange UM. Now, it may say, actually, I would tend to say, Exchange UM doesn't need to be highly available. But that's a matter of opinion. Depends on how much you use unified messaging. It's your voicemail platform. Now, how often do you receive voicemail? Me? Virtually never. Why? Because most of my contacts, people phone me, are people in Microsoft and they see my presence. And therefore, they aren't even going to bother to call me. The sort of people who rely on voicemail are those people who have a lot of outside contacts. And to them, high availability UM may be an issue. Right? Having voicemail for when they're not there may be something they need to require. Mediation servers. So are your mediation servers on your front ends, or are they separate? If they're separate, what happens if one of those goes down? What about multiple gateways? And there are pros and cons of multiple gateways versus multiple routes. Right? Sometimes multiple routes are okay, sometimes they're not. Often the multiple route is through another data center, so the call is going across the WAN, which means there's a bandwidth implication of multiple routes. Yeah? So think about those things. SIP trunk. If you're using SIP trunk, wonderful. It's great because it can fail over to another IP address automatically. Well, that's assuming you've got separate IP addresses and separate session border control devices. You need to think about each of the components. How many are you going to duplicate and how many are you not? I'm not saying you have to duplicate everything. Voice resiliency. How many people know what a survivable branch appliant is and how it works? A few. Good. It's all around the difference between registrar and user services. And if you want to understand the resiliency, you need to understand the difference. The registrar is all about registering my endpoint. It's saying, I know where that endpoint is, be that a link client, a link phone device, or whatever. That's all I know, where it is. I don't contain its presence, I just know how to get to it. The other thing the SBA has is routing information. So I know where that endpoint is, who signed into it, and I know their routing information. I know what numbers they're allowed to call and what routes out to make those calls. That's all it does. User services is all around presence and subscriptions and conferencing. It's where my presence updates go. It's where people subscribe to my updates. It's where I do conferencing, my multi-public conferencing units. So what matters? So here we've got some typical scenarios. So on the left here, we've got an inter-branch call. So Alice and Bob are on the same site. When they communicate with each other, be that making a call, that signaling just stays local. Alice calls Bob, the SBA knows where Bob is, it'll route the call to it. The signal just goes through the SBA, the media will go direct. Now let's take a different example. Alice is on the branch, but Bob's actually on the central site. So what happens there? Well, what happens there is, again, Alice talks to the registrar. The registrar says, oh, Bob's not on this server, but I know Bob is on that server up there. Well, that's where he's supposed to be, so I'll go and talk to that server. He goes to talk to the pool says, yes, Bob's registered. I'll send the invite to Bob, and then the media goes directly. If Alice wants to make a PSTN call, she just dials a number, it goes to the SBA. The SBA says, I know Alice, I've got Alice's routing plan, I can route it out through my media gateway, I can make that PSTN call. So what happens when we get failures? What happens when the WAN goes down? Well, Alice can still call Bob if they're on the same site. Alice will say, oh, I want to talk to Bob. Registrar says, yes, Bob's on this site, away you go. And the media will carry on going direct. Now, in the case where Alice is on the branch and Bob's on the main site, Alice will try and call Bob. The registrar will say, oh, Bob's actually up on the pool. Oh, I can't talk to the pool at the moment. And it'll say, Alice is allowed to do PSTN reroute. It's an option. Alice can do PSTN reroute. Oh, I will make the call out to PSN because I know what Bob's phone number is. I'll make that call. That call comes back in through a media gateway into the main site, and I can make that call. That's resiliency. I'll still be able to make that call even though that WAN link is down. Just audio. What happens if the SBA goes down, though? And this is where we have what we call a primary and a backup registrar. Alice, when the SBA goes down, her client will actually log out. And the client says, actually, I've got a backup registrar. I'll now register instead with the pool. So Alice has registered with the pool instead. Bob will have done the same thing. They will communicate through the pool. They can talk to the pool, away they go, and then talk to each other. In fact, they get no loss of functionality because the pool is providing user services as well for them. So different things happen depending on how outages happen. If the WAN's up, my client looks lovely. If I start getting WAN down and I've just got registrar services, then I will get that limited functionality tab. I get a notification saying, there's outages. Basically what it means is I can just make and receive calls. I can't do much else. When you look at most link deployments, it's primarily voice that has to be resilient. You know, if conferencing goes down for 10 minutes, people don't worry too much. If the phone system goes down for 10 minutes, you'll have the CIO jumping up and down. And this is where resiliency makes a difference. On the right-hand side, I've listed some of the features, and it's particularly ones at the bottom, what you don't get. Inter-site traffic between the branch and the central site, I don't get any IM, app sharing, anything like that. I don't get any conferencing. I get no presence information. I don't even see my contact list necessarily. I can't use response group to call Park because they're up on the main site. But I get quite a lot of features at the top. I can make and receive calls. I can do call forwarding, simultaneous ring, all that stuff still works. Even archiving still works. The SBA will queue up the archiving of the IM until such time as the archiving server is available and you can reach it. It's just in MSMQ. When you think about high availability and resilience and all the things, you have to think about other components as well, though. Active Directory. Is there Active Directory on the site or not? What's the implications of not having Active Directory on the site? That's where we use PIN authentication. But remember, all user settings are stored in Active Directory, so you need to be aware of that. DNS. We're very reliant on DNS for looking things up. If you look at some disaster recovery scenarios, sometimes you will want to change DNS. There is a time to live in DNS. What is it? Does that impact your RTO? Certificates. We're reliant on certificates. When you come to do recovery scenarios, you may need to use certificate. You may need to change certificate. You may need to do what I forgot to do with one of my customers last week, is put the right SANs in the certificates. And we didn't find out until we failed over to DR. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, these things happen at the wrong times for all sorts of reasons. And we found that we'd forgotten to put one of the extra SAN names in the SAN on the DR pool. Suddenly sign-in didn't work. We had to generate a new certificate very quickly. Be aware of that. Yes, we are very reliant on the network. And you can over-engineer things. I talk about resiliency, particularly when you're using SIP trunks and things like that, and central PSTN, and resiliency to sites. Do you put in dual network lines or not? And the sort of question I ask customers is, what do you do today for your telephony network? Do you have dual lines coming in from the PSTN, multiple trunks? And do those trunks go to two different places on your site? And are those trunks from two different exchanges? Yeah? How is it routed to? How much resiliency have you got in your voice network today? And it's surprising the answers you get. Often, they've got a single trunk coming in from one exchange. And they're saying, so why are you putting network resiliency in? It's the same thing. The risks are the same. Ish, similar. But assess that. If somebody has gone to the trouble of having multiple E1 lines, T1 lines, into a site in different locations from different exchanges, you want to try and make sure you've got the same resiliency built into your network. Yeah? I have one customer where they do that on most of their sites, except one they can't do it on. They have a site in a peninsula in Scotland, and unfortunately all lines will always come from the same exchange. So they have to accept the risk. But be aware of it. Ask those questions. Similarly, when you put in branch appliances, you know, if they've got two appliances in their site today for resiliency, you want to put in two SBAs. It's the same rules. Look at the same level of resiliency. Don't over-engineer it. You could duplicate everything. It is costly, and it doesn't solve all of your problems. Okay? You know, trying to get duplicate everything is expensive. We've published this wonderful Metropolitan Site Resiliency Solution. Not that word in there. It's not a DR solution. Right? What it's trying to address is for some scenarios where, particularly for the likes of conferencing, we want an extra degree of high availability and resiliency. Yeah? There are a lot of components in there. It's expensive. Very few customers I've got will implement. In fact, I haven't got any. I've got one who wants to implement it. And I'm trying to persuade them not to. Right? They are unusual. They actually meet some of the criteria that I would use as to whether you do this. One of the criteria is how far apart are your data centers and are they your only data centers? They're actually a city police department. And their data centers will only ever be within the city. So they'll always be within 20 miles of each other. And they're almost certainly always on the same part of the grid. They're always going to be hit by the same disasters. We don't have to have that many earthquakes in the UK. But we do have floods. And floods can be quite extensive. So they meet those sort of criteria. Is their network, have they got the dark fibre and the stretch subnet? Because you need those sort of things. But they're quite unusual. They have a feeling that they want that level of resiliency for conferencing. I'm not convinced they do. But we're having that discussion. Voice, it's like, well, you're going to have voice resiliency without doing all that. And I said, this doesn't solve all the problems because disaster recovery is not about a DR site. You need to develop a backup plan. How many of you start building without a plan? No. I've got my son at home at the moment building my decking. I ordered it before I left. I left him instructions. I'm hoping he read them. I'm not convinced. I'll wait and see when I get home. And that's true of a lot of things. Sometimes you develop these plans, and who actually reads them when you actually come to a disaster? Who actually tests them out and makes sure they're correct? When you're developing a plan, you need to think about the realm of disaster. That's what I call it. What you're trying to look at is, look at individual components. What would happen if that component failed? What would the impact be? Right? So look at individual components and think about what's the likelihood of it failing and what's the impact of it failing. Now, many of you know there are things called mean time between failures for disks and things. Well, when you're running a small data center, the chances are quite low. When you're running something like Office 365, you're going to have disk failures fairly often. You just don't know where they're going to be. So the way you address these things may be different. The next thing is to look at groups of components. What would happen if I lost a whole pool for whatever reason? And I say for whatever reason because you will never think through all the reasons. Yeah? And the ones you think about aren't the ones that are going to occur. But if you've thought about groups of components, then the chances are you'll be able to survive most disasters. So think about the groups of components. What happens if I lose a whole pool? Or what happens if I lose a whole site? Think through the different types of scenario failures. Hardware failure. What types of hardware failure? What would that mean? And some of that comes back to when you do recovery. Are you going to recover to other hardware in the same site or hardware in a different site? Think about human error. Yeah, operators, we give them PowerShell, they can do horrible things. Consultants like me can do horrible things. So you need to think about what you're doing to prevent that. Have you got a change control process? Even when you've got a change control process, typing away and creating a typo. What's going to happen if somebody types something incorrectly, even with change steps? Think about software failure. What happens if you put the latest update on and it causes a problem? How are you going to back it out? Do you need to test it somewhere else first? Think about the malicious. Ooh. Who can do destructive things? What privileges do I really need? Do I need to be a domain admin? Do I need to log on locally to the server? Yeah? Or should I actually be using remote PowerShell and role-based access controls? So think about what really is needed. I work with organizations and they run in those lockdown environments. And if you want to be a domain admin, we elevate your rights for a limited period, usually 24 hours. Right? And then they're taken away again. Because they recognize that sometimes you do need those rights, but they limit you to minimal rights for what you need to do on a day-to-day basis. And there are natural disasters. There are floods. There are earthquakes. Yeah? I've been in environments where a digger's gone through a power cable. The organisation I was working for was great at that point in time. They'd even thought about that. They had power coming in from two different substations. Unfortunately, over a period of time, the load they needed was more than one power line could supply. And suddenly, we couldn't do everything. And we had a situation where they ran the mainframe at the time, and basically, if you went in order processing, you were told to switch off your machine. Right? I put a boat up there for a reason. There was a famous ferry disaster just off the UK coast where a car ferry left the bow doors open and all the water went in and the sick ship sunk and fell over on its side. Analysis was done of that and other disasters. Seven changes cause a disaster. Little things cause a disaster. And that's the other thing. Changes will cause you problems. You need to test your DR recovery process on a regular basis. Because somebody will change something, and when the disaster occurs, is not the time to find out it doesn't work anymore. Right? So you need to test this on a regular basis. So how do we go about developing a plan? Well, what you do is you start thinking about different failures. So in the case of the front-end server, what does it provide? Think about what it's doing. You know, it's a registrar. It provides user services. It's got conferencing capabilities. There's an IIS website on there. How many of you have put in the mobility patch for mobility services? And how many of you did it on Windows Server 2008 and had to load the ASP fix? And how many of you had to edit the config file? Hands up if you haven't backed up the config file. Come on, be honest. Go home and do it. Little changes make a difference. Right? You need to get another service. A front-end server may or may not have mediation server and audio-video conferencing on it. Having decided what it provides, think about the consequences of losing that server. What will happen to the user? The user will establish a connection with another server in the pool. It will automate, once it can't talk to the server, it will try, and another server will say, oh, right, that server's not there, we'll rebalance the load, and away we go. But it does decrease the capacity of the pool. So have I allowed for N plus one servers? Or perhaps I might do N plus two. Web users will also get redirected to another server. The reach client could drop the connection for a while, but it will reconnect. If there was a conference hosted on that server, it will be recreated on the other front ends. If you came to my conference session this morning, I talked about the focus. The focus will recognize it's not there. The conference focus factory will recognize the server's gone. The conference request will come in, and it will spin it up on another server. Attendees will momentarily be dropped, and they'll reconnect. So generally deploy N plus one servers to make sure you've got the capacity. Wait for that. Additional backup. Remember your IIS configuration. It's the one that gets forgotten. How do we recover it? Well, the first thing is take it out of any DNS and hardware load balancing algorithms. Well, it depends on the thing. I say do that anyway. And stop IIS and linked services. The reason you do that is, while you are recovering it, the last thing you want is the other front ends thinking it's there and all working hunky-dory. By taking it out of DNS and load balancing and stopping the services, you make sure the other services don't suddenly think it's there when it's not ready yet. You may restore it to the same server hardware, or you may be restoring to new server hardware. So if it's the same hardware, you may or may not need to re-import certificates. You run bootstrap or reapply the topology and restore the service. If it's going to a new server, Well, what you might do, it might be a different server name. So you have to remove the old server from topology, add a new server in, install link, install new certificates, update DNS, update the hardware load balancing configuration, and away you go. So do think about the processes that might be involved. We look at a director server. How many of you deployed directors? Yeah. So think about the impact of a director. It handles that initial user registration request, right? Internal and external. And so this is where we found out I had a SAN missing from one of my servers. We had a director failure, and suddenly it was going to the backup server and it couldn't sign in because it didn't have the right SAN. It affects the client's ability to get primary and backup registrars. That registrar process of primary and backup is based on the fact that my client initially signed in to director or to the wrong pool. Yeah? Because at that point, I get given my primary and backup registrar services. The director is also the next top for edge, potentially. So you need to think, well, what happens if I lose a director? It's the target for simple URLs. You came to my conferencing session this morning, simple URLs. Often, you proxy out the director to take that load. So it may be the target for simple URLs. Well, the concept is, well, users wouldn't be able to authenticate. You know, loss of a server, diminished capacity on the edge. All that edge traffic goes through the director. If you lose a director, have you scaled the directors enough for that? If you lose a pool, then you lose your federation route and remote user access. What's the impact of that? So how can you protect? Well, obviously you can deploy multiple director servers in a pool. You can create secondary SRV records. So that underscore SIP internal, underscore SIP, you can create second SRV records so it can find alternative places. Be aware it does take time for it to fail. You know, client's not going to get instant sign-in. It's going to try the first SRV record, and they have to wait for a TCP timeout, which is about 30 seconds, before it'll try the next one. So it's not instantaneous. But at least user can sign in. You can always deploy a second set of edges and directors. Make sure you create firewall rules for those alternate routes, though. Again, remember IIS configuration. I said you've got IIS, simple URLs, SRV records. How many of you back up your SRV records? I had an interesting situation with a customer. We were deploying we're actually going from OCS to Link. We were deploying Link servers, and we put the Link edge in, and the customer, I let them do the typing, the customer went to their firewall that was providing the DNS service to the perimeter network and externally, and added the new edge records. Unfortunately, it was an old firewall. And one of the interesting features of this firewall was it didn't support SRV records in the GUI. You had to use the text file. Unfortunately, as soon as you used to use the GUI, it deleted all the SRV records. Who's backing them up? Right? We had to go and recreate them. Similarly with firewall rules. You know? If you've got to rebuild your firewall, because it's gone kaput, how are you going to make sure you put all the firewall rules back? When we come to server recovery, again, think about the same sort of steps. It's about taking it out of any load balancing so it's not trying to be used. It's going through a similar sort of process for a server. Reinstall the certificates, run Bootstrapper, or reinstall from new if you're doing it on a new server. If you're doing pool recovery, then it's thinking about, well, hold it, I may need to change up topology. If I've lost a director pool, I may want to reroute my federation route to a different pool next hop. That's a topology change. I may need to update firewall to allow that communication flow. I may need to update SRV records. Again, restoring to normal service, fix the pool, and then put it all back. What about an SBA failure? An SBA provides that user registrar service. It has a certificate. It has call routing information. Well, the consequences are if you lose an SBA, well, the users will actually connect to their backup. they won't actually get a full experience. But the chances are their inbound calls may not be received. If it's the termination point for their DID numbers, they may not get inbound calls. And some of that depends on what failover capability you've got with your telephony provider. Are they providing multiple E1 lines, balancing them? Do you put them into separate SBAs? Outbound calls, generally they can make, but that depends on your routing configuration. Have you given them alternative routes? Sorry, I'm Rebecca. Routes. So have you given them another way to get out? Protection measures. Ensure users log on with a path that allows them to discover their backup registrar so they go through a director. Configure a dial plan that you've got those extra ways out. Additional backup. List of users assigned to a registrar. You'll see this in the demo in a bit. You need to think about those. Think about who is on that SBA, because when I move them around, I need to be able to move them back. The SBA itself. I've just been configuring one for a customer, and of course you go through the nice web page and you do all this configuration. Who's backing up that configuration of the SBA? Because of the media gateway in there that you may be configuring. DHCP configuration. So, often with SBAs, we've got option 43 and option 120 in DHCP. Who's responsible for making sure that's backed up? So what do I back up? There is a document telling you a lot of this. There's configuration information. CS configuration, LIS configuration. There's also things like IP addresses, certificates, root certs, potentially, on the edge. Active Directory. Use, has that as user configuration and your RT service configuration. When you look at data, there's the SQL databases. There is the main SQL database. Every server has a local SQL database. Do you need to back it up, don't you? Generally not, because what it is a copy of what's on the main SQL database, or it's transient data. So it's either a copy of CMS, or it's transient information about who's registered. File shares, who's backing up your file shares? And when you start looking at recovery time objectives and recovery point objectives, how often are they backed up? User-specific information. It's one people forget. When you start coming to do some of this recovery stuff, you'll actually find having user-level data is important. It's a bit like exchange data. People love bricks-level backup of mailboxes, be able to restore a single item. If I back up the SQL database, that's everything. I've got to restore the whole lot. Being able to back up user-specific data and do that. Is there any server-specific data? As I said, IIS configuration. Other sort of things. So there's a lot of things that are common to all servers. A general backup of the OS. So a general server backup. Backup certificates. We use certificates everywhere. Are you backing up those certificates? How are you going to recover them? What's the process? Because some organizations I deal with, it can take 24 hours to get a new certificate. That's not really what you want to do if you've got a disaster. Yeah? So you need to think about those things. Link configuration is stored in CMS. I said backup CS configuration and LIS configuration. If you ever come to restore CMS, you need the LIS configuration as well. Even if you're not using location services. Even if it's empty, you need the file. So backup script. Let's have a look at backups. I'm hoping my servers are now working. This is my demo system. It all runs on my laptop. Just log back in. So I'm going to just fire up PowerShell. Waiting, I'll load up the control panel while we're waiting. This is when you hope your demos all work. Dialog box. Oh. I'll move it to the top so you can see it. Okay. I'm going to run a script called backup. What that's going to do is back up my server. It's actually running at the moment as it goes. It's actually doing things even though you can't see them. I forgot to put displays in, and it's going to fail. Otherwise, my services aren't running. This is what happens when you have a reboot. Fortunately, I recorded these beforehand. And even that isn't working. Do you feel it's going to be one of those days? I'm going to do it on this machine. Oh, have we got a USB for this? Okay, so this will show you running of the script. I recorded them beforehand just in case these sort of things happen. So here's my front end server. I fire up PowerShell. And I'm going to run the backup script. The backup script will run. What it's doing is backing up the configuration. I write a lot of script. If you're not used to PowerShell, get used to it. It's a great tool. Test your scripts, retest them. I've run this PowerShell script again and again. It's going to back up the configuration. It's going to do some user export of data and a few other things. You'll see it run through. Do an export. Oh, it's using RoboCopy. Have you used a RoboCopy and XCopy? All those sort of things. And there the scripts run. This is what the script looks like. As you can see, there's lots of things in there. Very, very complex. Lots of if, buts. It does things like... I'll show it to you now. It does things like test, does the file exist? And things like that. So there's a lot of other things in that script. What I've done here is scrunch it down to the main components. This isn't everything, right? This is just a sample backup script. So the first thing, it's doing an export of CS configuration, right? It's going to export that to a configuration file. That uses a parameter because I parameterize everything. It exports the list configuration. It does a DB import export. This is a tool that enables you to export stuff from the database to an export file for a particular server. It exports the response group configuration. Yes, there is a utility for exporting response groups. It's exporting response groups configuration. It does a RoboCopy. I love RoboCopy. It's not the only backup tool. It doesn't back up the way you might think. It keeps a complete copy of everything. So if you delete something, it doesn't delete it from the copy. It does overwrite things. So it's not quite the same as backup, but I happen to use it in this utility. And what I'm doing here is I'm backing up the file share. Right? The next thing I'm doing is root print. Have I created any static roots? Particularly on your edge servers, you might have. Right? Things you forget about. IP configuration. What is my IP configuration? Have I got multiple network cards? What does that mean? I put those to text files locally and then copy them to a backup share. Right? In fact, the config files go to that same thing. What that XCopy is doing is saying, copy all my stuff from here to my backup share. The next one, System32 int server, is a command to backup IIS. Backup my IIS configuration. And finally, the last one, there's a few things go before that in the script, is an export of my certificate. All scripted. So, having backed up my server, what happens if I get a disaster? What happens if I lose a machine? So here's my environment. Here I have a client running. Bob is signed in. You can see his configuration information. He's signed into Link 2010. That's the pool he's signed into. Here's my Hyper-V. I'm going to pause my front-end server. Instigate a server pool failure. Okay? So I've paused my front end. Bob, you can see, is actually still working. At some point, he will go to limited functionality mode. Okay? I go to my backup server and run my move user script. I've decided disaster. I need to move all these users to my backup pool. So I run my move user script. My move user script goes through and does a whole load of lovely things around moving users across from one pool to another while the pool isn't there, moving the conference directories. If you came to my session this morning around conferencing, there's a thing called a conference directory. What enables you when you dial into a conference, you dial that conference ID to actually know where that is. That's held in the conference directory. So what does my script do? just going to pull up the script in just a minute. Okay. Well, again, my script does a lot of things. And again, I've cut it down. The first thing I do is export everything to a CSV file. Which users are on the pool that I'm moving them from? Why do I want to do that? Well, how will I know which users to move back when that pool is restored? So I move the users, export them. I then do a get of that same file. As I said, I'm a consultant. I've been there. Make sure you use the thing you think you're saving as a thing to drive things, just in case that export didn't work or exported things you weren't expecting. So I use that same export file to drive the next piece. I go and do a get user, and I then re-import it. I then, for each one of those, I'm going to move the user, and with the force command, I force them across. What enables a link to do is saying, move them and forget about their data. It just moves the user across. I then do the same thing with the conference directory. I find which conference directories were on that server and force them across. Right? I then use my DB import export from my last backup, yeah, my recovery point, and use that to restore data. So I do a DB import of their data. Okay? That's what he's doing at the end. And then finally, it does a get just to show you that it's done it. One thing to be aware of, that DB import export, the importing of data, doesn't always work. There is a delay between me doing the force user over and all the services in link knowing that they're there. If you do the import too quickly, it won't import. It'll just show as errors. Yeah? And sometimes it's not always obvious. Okay? Because it's just an error count. And you will get an error count anyway. So you need to be aware of what's actually happening. So sometimes you need to run the import slightly later. Just wait a couple of minutes and then run it. Okay? Just be aware of that. So that's how I move users. Very, very simple, very, very easy. When I've actually got round to restoring my server, I can then move those users back. So in this case, what I did was I just went to Hyper-V. Oh, there you can see Bob's. Bob's got all his contacts. You know, that's because the import, he kept all his contacts. I'm going to resume my front end there, bring my pool back online. I've done all the right things. It's now working. And then I've got another script, which is called Restore Users. And you can see, as I'm moving that Bob across, he signed out and signed back in. Because he was online, he knows about the move. He will sign it out and back in straight away. And you can see now Bob's back on Link Pool 2010. So how did all that work? Again, I use the same CSV file I'd done on when I moved the users. Oh, be aware, I was playing with this when I was testing it. I ran the first skip twice, it overwrote the file and blanked it out. Yeah, just be careful what you do. Make sure you back these things up away through the process. But it uses that same file, it does for each, it does move the user. It does the same thing for conferencing directories. The one thing you will see is missing there is an import. Well, because the backup server was online, when I did the move, it will move the data anyway. I don't need to re-import it. And again, I just do a get at the end to make sure it all works. That's how easy it is. Now, that's a condensed version of my script. You saw the first one. It had loads and loads of more lines. Scripting is not just trivial stuff like this. You have to think about all the circumstances. Does the directory exist? Does the file exist? I used Xcopy in mine. I wouldn't always use Xcopy. It depends on how you're backing these things up. No, you can't have my scripts. Because they take into account lots of things about an environment. What else is going on? Who's responsible for different things? How does the general backup happen? I just put all my stuff to a backup directory and assume that's being backed up. You know, that's not always the case. Read the guide, the backup and restore guide. Yeah, that's the URL, all of it, little lines in it. Backup information about your infrastructure, such as your firewall configuration, load balancing configuration, IIS, etc., etc. All those little things I've told you about that people forget, they are in the guide. And people still forget them. Continually test your recovery process. So little changes, you'll suddenly find something doesn't work anymore. Right? So to summarize, high availability is about keeping a service up and running. It's generally about N plus one. It's about having multiple routes, different ways of getting out. Resiliency is about keeping essential services up and running, not everything. That's where SBAs come in and where the Metropolitan Site Resiliency comes in. Disaster recovery is not just about a DR site. It's about a set of backup and restore processes. Exports and imports matter as much as general backups. Right? Having that data be able to restore individual groups of components. As I said, human error. The one I didn't show you was the one from my human error. Within Control Panel, there is an option in voice routing called export configuration and import configuration. It's one of the few things that is not in PowerShell, right? It's one of the few things you can't script, but is extremely useful when you come to change any voice routing information, right? I always go and do it before I go and change a customer voice routing. First thing I do is an export of the current configuration so that if I make a mistake, I can put it back. The reason it's there and not in PowerShell, it's not just a trivial case of get root, set root, or new root. There's a lot more to it than that. It's a lot more complex than that. I've written PowerShell to create voice plans and dial plans. 20 sites, 1,000 lines of PowerShell command. Yeah, it's surprising how it adds up. And that's why that export is there, because it makes it a lot easier. So, have we got any questions? Now do you all know what to go back and do? All the things I've mentioned that you've forgotten to back up? And things to consider when you come to DR. And you'll see, I hope you've seen that DR isn't about a DR site. It's about thinking about what disasters can occur and how can you recover from. It doesn't mean to say you don't need a DR site. You might well. But it's not the be-all and end-all of disaster recovery. I've put a couple of links in the slide decks if you load them down. If not, you can find them on TechNet. They're all TechNet links to documentation. Please remember to fill in your evals on ComNet. Any questions? We've got about 6 minutes for questions. Come to the mic so everybody can hear, please.
Are there any scenarios where you think that instead of having Link running in one place and recovering it to another place, that you would try and do what it seems like SQL Azure is doing, where you have multiple copies of it in the same place? So, for example, you'd have a pool in your main data center, and you'd have a pool running on VMs in your secondary data center, so that if you have to fail over, right? Your pool is already up and running and it's all there ready to go. It's just a matter of swinging the users and DNS over there versus something like this, given sort of that virtual machines now are a mainline model.
Effectively, what I did with the move use there is effectively that. You know, that DR pool could just be any pool anywhere with no users on.
Or it could be a pool. Okay, so it doesn't have to be in the same place. It can be across the country.
It can be anywhere. Okay. You know, I said the one I did at 1 o'clock in the morning about 2 weeks ago, we happened to have created a DR pool. We hadn't fully configured it and tested it. And we had a scenario that suddenly said, the only option we've got is to go to DR now, even though we haven't tested it. And we just moved everybody across and went from the backup. I said we had a few glitches where we missed a sand because we hadn't had a chance to test it. But yeah, that pool can be anywhere. Often what I see is, particularly in geographical scenarios, where you just move them over to an existing pool. So often, you know, if you think about a pool high available, 10,000 users on each server, how many customers you've got with more than 10,000 users per a geography? Not that many. I mean, there are some out there. I deal with them. So often they've got spare capacity. It takes their N plus one out, yeah? But they've got capacity there to take that extra user load, yeah? So often you're moving them to another existing pool.
Okay, thanks.
So the scenario that you drew out on the screen with the scripts to move users to another pool and so on, is there a better geographical pool solution for multi-site resiliency? Like I thought that the Link client could do dual pool registration.
From Link will sign in, but it hasn't got its user data.
Okay.
So part of what we're doing with Move User is saying, now that server's going to provide its user services, and the import says, here's the user's data, both their contact information and their directory information.
Okay. So all they get is IAM and presence. They don't get their contact list.
They would do. Once I move them across that Move User, they get the whole contact list, everything. All services.
Even if the source pool is offline?
Yeah. That's why you have to use the minus force command on the thing to force them across. So the force forces them across. Right. They have no data. I then use an import to put their data back.
Right. That's the only way to recover the data into an alternate pool is to import the data.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Is there any... I'm not going to ask. Is there anything on the roadmap for geo-resiliency?
I'm not going to answer. If you can bring me a signed NDA, I'll talk to you somewhere else.
We have one, actually.
So. Yeah, but I need to see it.
I'll talk to our...
database onto the same SQL backend pool?
Can I coexist the group chat database? I'd have to look it up. It is in the docs in terms of what we support. I can't remember whether it has to be on a separate instance or not. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your time. Have a good rest of the day.